The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. So many goals, 39 in 8 games. We'll rank every single one with the chart music behind it. Liverpool scored 2 of them with the help of keeper Arrizabalaga. Wilfried Zaha scores 2 with the help of VAR and a generous Manchester United defence. 7 goals at Everton with 3 for Calvert-Lewin. 7 at Southampton with 4 identical Kane to Sons for Spurs. And 7 at Elland Road as Leeds have another 4-3 while Leicester and Burnley disappoint by only managing 6 between them. Tarek Lamptey still good and Arsenal hold off West Ham. Elsewhere in League 2, Cambridge United at top of the league. All that, some alpacas, an indie band speak up, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson, hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm really well, thanks. How are you?
Not too bad, thanks, yeah.
Great. Lars Sivertsen, how are you?
Hi, Max.
Are you well?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, good. And Marcus Bean, nice to see you.
Hi, Max, how are you doing, mate?
I'm very good. Gerard says, could you just ask Marcus if he's keeping well? Seems like a nice bloke.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Gerard. I'm perfectly fine, thank you.
Excellent news. There you are, Gerard. Yeah, your mind is at ease now to know that Marcus Bean is keeping well. Georgely Stewart says, awesome set of mostly free-flowing games this weekend. Do players actually prefer to play without the pressure of fans inside the stands? Is this just random? Occasionally there are lots of goals in the Premier League.
Yeah, and I looked at the... I won't go into my reasons for scepticism over XG, but I looked at the XG for those 8 games. So there's 39 goals scored, but there was only 26.55 goals expected. So it was, you know, I think it's just one of those weekends where a lot of shots went in. I did wonder, and look, this is totally without any foundation other than a thought I had quite late on Saturday night. I think the ball's really nice.
Okay.
And I think that makes it easier to hit. So in the same way that the South Africa World Cup was ruined by a terrible ball, I think this might be an excellent ball. Because it also, as well as the 39 goals, there were at least 4 occasions when the woodwork was hit. Maybe more. There's 4 that came immediately to mind. So, I think it's a good ball, is what I'm saying. I'm calling it now. It's a good ball this season.
I think you can divide football fans into 2 categories. Those who look at a lot of goals over a weekend and go searching for the XG, and the rest of us who don't, personally.
Even I didn't do that. but I'd quite like to know what actual footballer Marcus Bean thinks of this no crowd business. Would it make you sharper, or would it make you looser, so to speak?
I always found that playing, you know, behind closed door friendlies, etc., kind of makes you feel quite relaxed. I think, you know, as we know, when the fans are there, there's added pressure. I think players, normally the creative players, feel a little bit more able to express themselves. And I think we're seeing a little bit of that at the moment. And I put part of that is definitely down to some of the goals we've seen this weekend, I think.
And as Wilson mentioned, the ball itself, right? We all know when you get a good match ball. But did you have seasons where you go, we're playing with this, this is rubbish?
I never had seasons, but I remember just mitre balls, and they're generally in the EFL have always been mitre from my memory. But going into non-league, I thought some of these balls are terrible. I know, we always used to try and use our balls against non-league teams in pre-season, and never worked because they saw that as a leveller. But yeah, some of the non-league balls were poor.
I love that. A ball being a great leveller is a real sign, isn't it?
It's like just kicking a brick, some of them. It's like kicking a brick, seriously. You try and change a play and it just trickles along the floor.
The Ryman League just bringing out a square ball saying, right, try and play with that.
Well, the 1930 World Cup final, they used a different ball in each half because they couldn't agree which ball to use. So the Argentinians used one in the first half and the Uruguayans used theirs in the second half.
And
Uruguay won. But, you know, that was their way of settling this dispute over, because it wasn't like an official World Cup ball. So each team brought along their own ball and wanted to use that. And so they used one in each half.
That's great. Stamford Bridge then, Chelsea 0, Liverpool 2. I mean, the red card changes this game. Andreas Christensen, the first player to be sent off in a Premier League game between Chelsea and Liverpool since Frank Lampard in February 2009. Going to Lars Lars, I had this thought when I was watching Paul Tierney watching the replay and thinking, should he be watching that in real time to get an idea if Kepa is going to get to the ball, or is that irrelevant? My feeling was, if
That Henderson pass is ridiculously good, right? And it's very hard to tell if Mane's going to get there before Kepa. But if he'd wildly overhit that and it goes into Kepa's hands, if Christensen does the same rugby tackle, it's just a yellow card, isn't it? Because he's not denying a goalscoring opportunity.
Yeah, no, what they were trying to determine was whether Mane would have gotten to it. And I guess why they were watching it slowly was to get the exact distance the ball was and see the distance of Mane's stride and whatever. I don't know. I thought it was fine, to be honest. I think he probably would have gotten there. So for me, it looked okay.
It was a mistake from Kepa. And the second goal was a mistake from Kepa, Marcus. I mean, you sort of wonder, should Lampard have picked him?
I think he probably doesn't have his full faith in Caballero, and he's just waiting for Mendy coming. And this has definitely made up his mind now. I think as soon as the new keeper comes in, Kepa will be out. Should he have picked him? I don't know. I don't know what's been going on in training.
But how little faith can he have in Caballero?
Yeah, that's a good question. I just think it's also a case of, you know, you spend that much money on a keeper, you need to protect his value a little bit, and just completely bombing out at the start of the season, it probably doesn't help. So I think they just wanted to keep him around.
We've gotten to the point with Kepa now that sort of pundits are starting to say that we should feel sorry for him rather than he's bad, which I guess there's logic to that, because obviously he's having a very bad time and he doesn't look very confident. I still am not fully over the fact that this is a guy who refused to go off when he was being subbed not that long ago, which remains one of the most sort of schoolyard nonsensey things that have happened in the Premier League in recent times. And I'm not quite there in terms of feeling sorry for him yet. I mean, if you back yourself to the point where you refuse to come off when you're told, I'm not going to feel that bad for you when you have a terrible run of form after.
But I mean, I think that's illustrative of just how shot his confidence has been. But I actually think there's a wider issue. So Kepa last season saved 54.5% of shots on target against him, which is the lowest percentage ever recorded by a first-choice keeper in the Premier League since they started collecting these stats in 2003. So that is lower than the 67.5% he had the previous season, 68.2% when he was in La Liga. So, you know, his level is roughly, you know, his mid-high 60s, and that's dropped down to 54.5%. Now, if you look at Willy Caballero, his save percentage last season was 56.3%, so fractionally better than Kepa. Now, it's only over five games, so it's, you know, it's not a huge sample size. His previous three clubs was over 70% every time. In his previous five starts for Chelsea, was 78.2%, so huge drop off there. Scott Carson at Derby, his shots on target save percentage was 66% under Lampard, as against a career average of 71.5%. So, in defence of Kepa, whose confidence is clearly shot and clearly needs second out of the firing line, and I actually think he would have been sent off had Christensen not been sent off. Yeah, I think he would have fouled Mane there. So, yeah, clearly he had a very, very bad game, and clearly, yeah, he needs protecting. But there does seem to be a pattern that Frank Lampard kills goalkeepers.
It's interesting. Last week we did the pod about, there was a sort of a sense from some Chelsea fans that we were becoming almost sort of personally anti Frank Lampard, that there was perhaps a will to him for him not to do very well. And I'm not sure. It's almost like there was a reaction against how much positive press he was getting from, you know, people on the pod and elsewhere. And now I feel I want to have a reaction against that, and I want to become incredibly partisan towards Frank Lampard and not really judge what's happening on the pitch.
Well, I mean, as far as I can be sure of these things, it's not personal. I think that we've seen over the two seasons and two games he's been in charge of clubs that his sides leak loads of goals from cross-set plays and one-on-ones. Now, what that means is that the chances that are being created against Chelsea are relatively easy to take. So you would expect then the keeper's save percentage to drop, and that then has a sort of a almost a self-fulfilling effect, that the keeper's confidence is then hit, and so they're less likely to save even those shots, and things just spiral and get worse and worse. Is my theory. It's two seasons. It may turn out that he gets a keeper who's got incredibly robust self-confidence. He's very good in one-on-ones. And Keller Rose, who played, I think, 16 games for him at Derby, actually has a fractionally higher save percentage record under Lampard than the rest of his career. So it may be that the Carson and Willy and Kepa are not the right sort of keeper. But Yeah, all I'm offering you is the stats, which suggest there is a problem there beyond Kepa having lost his nerve.
When there has been criticism leveled at Frank Lampard from this pod, it seems to be mainly people pointing out that his team leaks a bunch of goals and, you know, didn't take that many points in the grand scheme of things last season. And these sort of facts that are thrown into the mix, I don't think that means it's personal and that everyone hates Lampard. I saw the suggestion after Barney wrote a piece at the weekend where he sort of pointed out that, you know, for all he's undoubtedly worked hard and all of that, Frank Lampard has had opportunities that a lot of other young managers wouldn't have had. And a lot of the response was like, oh, they hate Frank Lampard. That's not really hate. That's pointing out something very obvious. It seems that a lot of people who like Frank Lampard has a very thin skin about these things, not unlike Frank Lampard himself, it seems.
Well, I suppose, in life, we get frustrated if perhaps a prime minister went to Eton and, you know, had all the privileges that mean he became prime minister and he may not have done had he not. And I wonder, in football, Marcus, is there that kind of sort of patronage / privilege that you may get because of who you are and what your, you know, where your family is or who you were as a player, I guess. And if there is that feeling within the game of that kind of elitism, if you see what I mean.
No, there's definitely that feeling of elitism in the game. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of management and staff recruitment does come down to who you know and who you're affiliated with, which is makes it very difficult for the next generation and people coming through, coaches. And yeah, I don't think it's a, personally, I don't think it's an anti-Lampard campaign. I just think people are just telling the truth, in my opinion. Going back to Jonathan's point about keepers, Chelsea conceding easy goals or easy shots on target, I think that game against Liverpool, Lampard's defence was a lot better. They were a lot more compact, and I think they did restrict Liverpool. So I think that's something that they've clearly been working on all over the summer, but there's still lots of problems at Chelsea for Lampard.
Well, Marcus, what did you make of Liverpool's performance?
I thought it was good. I thought they controlled the game. They looked comfortable. They restricted Chelsea to a few glimpsing moments on the counter-attack through Werner, who did look very good on the day and looks like he's adapted very well, showed why Klopp wanted him. But I thought it was the performance of the champions, if I'm honest with you.
Sadio Mane scored both goals. I thought they made quite a good point in commentary about, you know, the second goal, Wilson, is about hard work, right? And we often talk about players who have some talent but don't necessarily put it in. And if you're as talented as Mane and you're still really busting it, that is, you know, that's part of being a brilliant footballer.
Yeah, completely. I thought he was, you know, I thought all the front three of Liverpool were really good, but he was the pick of them. I mean, yeah, easy to say when he scored the two goals, but it would have been very easy for him not to be in that position to intercept that. And it, you know, it's him being there that puts the pressure on Kepa that makes him make the mistake. And I think you can contrast that with, I mean, this is a minor point, but if you look at the first Palace penalty against United, the Jordan Ayew penalty, so he doesn't hit it particularly hard, fine, but he hasn't moved from penalty spot. Jordan Ayew hasn't reacted to the fact that ball might be pushed back out. And you sort of think, well, what are you doing? Why are you just standing there? If he moved even 5 yards forward, he probably would have got to the rebound first and we wouldn't have had the penalty retaken and we wouldn't have had Zaha scoring the goal. So, yeah, just being switched on and kind of putting the effort in, I mean, it's obvious, but it clearly helps.
Lars, something was made about whether Fabinho would be able to do the job at centre-half. And he was sort of peerless there, wasn't he? He was superb, especially against Timo Werner, who, as Marcus said, looks like a really fantastic prospect for Chelsea.
Yeah, I think it was something like his third or fourth game in his career playing in that position, and it certainly didn't look that way. He's obviously very, very good in these one-on-ones on the ground, which helped him in the sort of situations he got into with Timo Werner, but he definitely looked, albeit aided by the fact they played half the game with the man more. So it was a sort of, the way the game went, it will have suited him quite well, because they had a lot of possession. And as a midfielder, he'll be very comfortable with that. But he definitely looked like he's a viable option in that position, which is very good news for Liverpool.
You mentioned, obviously, that red card also made it the nicest half for Thiago to come in and just pass the ball around. You know, all these statistics about Thiago, and yeah, he completed 75 passes, more than any Chelsea player managed in the entire match, the most by any player who's played a maximum of 45 minutes. I wonder, I think I would have played quite a lot of passes if I'd played holding midfield 11 against 10 in that Liverpool team. But he has a sort of aesthetic beauty as a footballer, which few can match, I think, just in the way he reminds me of a kind of Premier League Marcus Bean. That's how I but don't think Marcus, just the way he just every like his the way he glides and the way he moves and the way he passes the ball is a joy to watch.
Yeah, the way he passes the ball, when he passes it stays hit. It's just beautiful. The way he whips it round people when he's playing it out wide. I think he just gives Liverpool a whole new dimension, and for me, I'd start him in that holding position, because what teams like to do against teams like Liverpool is let the holding midfield have it, saying he's their least dangerous player. But when you've got a player like Thiago and who's able to, you know, his passing is, you know, his generational talent, especially with his passing, he's able to unlock defences from that deep position. It gives teams so many problems. They're going to have to start putting pressure on him, because he will hurt you from there.
So who are your three then? If you're starting Thiago, you have Henderson, who can do that role, you know, has been playing the sort of eight a bit more, haven't you? Who are your three?
I think Thiago holding, Henderson eight alongside Keita. That'd be my three. Yeah.
Mm. Oh, that you were sort of, you made a noise, Lars, as if somebody had just put a big roast dinner in front of you.
Well, I just like the sound of that. And I think it's such a clever addition for Liverpool, because you might think that Thiago, you know, the very elegant and measured Thiago isn't an obvious sort of Jurgen Klopp player, because of course you associate him with the sort of heavy metal football and the gegenpressing and all the jumping up and down and that sort of thing. But ever since he came, every season, Liverpool have sort of gradually completed more and more short passes throughout the season, if you look at the numbers, because as much as Klopp probably wants to play sort of high energy and quite direct and vertical, as they like to say, you know, teams aren't giving them the choice. Teams aren't giving them that option, because everyone knows Liverpool are really good, so they sit back, and more it becomes about controlling midfield and finding openings and stuff. So adding someone who's very good at that, just to give them something new and to give them that option, it seems really, really clever.
Let's move on to the Palace win at Manchester United then. 3-1, brilliant win for Palace. Their second win in two at Old Trafford. They have a knack of winning at top six clubs, Wilson. Have you got any idea why? Because they have a knack of not really winning a lot generally.
I mean, I think the way Roy Hodgson sets them up, they're very solid, very hard to break down. McCarthy and MacArthur were clearly brilliant on Saturday. Yeah, Zaha on the break, you know, is sort of, you know, the perfect outlet, given, you know, he has both the technical skill and the pace. So, you know, I just think they're well set up to play on the break, and they're good at frustrating notionally better teams.
Sean says, can we talk Palace without making it all about Zaha and point out that Andros Townsend's return to the starting lineup has been important? Lars, I would like a minute on Crystal Palace, and if you mention Wilfried Zaha, you're never allowed on the podcast ever again.
Okay, I think with Palace, I've certainly made the mistake that I think a lot of other people do looking at Palace going into the season, is that we look at the team and we think, well, there's a lot of really average-looking footballers here, isn't there? They'll probably have a bad time. But then the way they're set up under Hodgson, they're so organised, and it might not always be super exciting to watch, and it certainly I don't think it's very exciting for the players, because Hodgson does a tremendous amount of sort of like tactics and the sort of where to stand, that sort of coaching. So the training is apparently really boring, but it does get results. And I saw this stat that Palace themselves put out: only Man City have won more away games against the big six than Palace since May 2015, which is extraordinary, and it is a huge sort of, as much as it's not fashionable, I guess, is a word you could use, and not always exciting, it is a huge sort of testament to the work Hodgson has done there.
Marcus, how many managers have you had who have done, as Lars says, very boring, where you should stand type training?
I had a few, and to be honest, they're probably the best ones, because it's second nature when you step on the football pitch. It's like that repetition that you've done in training, you just know the options, and you know it makes the game a lot easier. I think all the great managers, from what I understand, do a lot of that, a lot of unopposed passing drills, so everyone understands their role, and there's no excuses. And when the manager says, why didn't you do this, you know your role and you know your job, and I don't mind it personally. You do need to sprinkle in a few five-a-sides here and there, else the boys do lose their head, but it's a balancing act for sure.
Yeah, I was going to say that. How do you keep, if every day you're just doing the same, mind you, I mean, I seem to spend my whole time on Zoom talking to people, so I'm sure a lot of people listening do the same thing every day, but I think it's something. Training is something that we never really talk about, you know. But actually, it's so important for players because it's what you're doing 90% of the time.
One of the first managers, and he was foreign, which makes sense, was who instilled this in me was Uwe Rosler. Before that, no manager I ever had done as much that sort of repetitive training before. And to be honest, after a few weeks, the boys were like, listen, we all understand our roles. Yes, it's boring, but we're a better team. So everyone bought into it.
If you look at Roy Hodgson's Fulham team, there were a bunch of sort of random Scandinavians knocking around that squad who sort of never played and who weren't very good. Like when they moved on from Fulham to where they places where, like Tony Kallio, for instance, the random Finnish defender who was in there who never played and later on in his career turned out wasn't that good. I think he wanted them there because, you know, he hardly ever rotates. So it's the same 11. So if you're not in the 11, you're not going to be in the 11 anytime soon, and training is super boring in addition. So what you want, you just need guys who are like sort of vaguely athletic people who you can have in training who will not complain and who will do these formation drills, and it's kind of fine, even though they know they're never going to play football anytime soon. And yeah, he had a fair few of those at Fulham, Roy Hodgson did.
People who are also just not inquisitive generally about life.
I'm quite happy standing in two banks of four and training every day of the week.
The penalty incident was like a VAR dream, wasn't it, Wilson? One of those handballs, some off-the-line goalkeeping. Any thoughts on it?
I don't understand anything anymore. Like, I mean, that handball, the thing is, like, it looks different depending which camera you see it from. I can't even work out which bit of his hand it hit. There's one angle where it looks like it clips his chest on the way onto his arm. So Lindelof is no distance from Ayew. I mean, how long afterwards was the review? It was a good 2 minutes or so. You know, nobody appealed for it. I mean, it was a weekend where there's loads of penalties awarded that nobody appealed for. You know, the Chelsea penalty nobody appealed for. The Fulham penalty nobody appealed for. Which maybe also is a facet of no fans there, that you're not sort of appealing to get the crowd to put pressure on the ref. I mean, maybe technically under the law that is a handball these days, but then the law is a joke.
Hugh says, should another player be allowed to take a retaken penalty? I think that's a good question. I think absolutely whoever missed the first one should have to step up again.
Well, no, but what if he slips while taking it and shatters his kneecap? You know, it's
tough luck, mate.
I mean, I'm not sure that happens very often.
Yeah, but it might happen. Yeah, the whole thing with VAR that we've learned is that unlikely things happen quite a lot when you kind of invite them to happen.
What about United, Lars? Mitigating circumstances for them or the full meltdown that we've obviously seen on social media?
Well, it doesn't have to be either, but it's yet again, it's the same as last year in games where they can't counterattack and where they don't have space to attack into. And, you know, Palace are obviously one of the ones who are the best at sitting back and just standing in the right places, as we discussed. They don't enjoy those games, and you're reliant on individual players having good days at the office. And when that happens, there's no sort of pattern of play or anything like that to fall back on. And it all looks a bit random and, you know, like they don't have much of a plan. And I don't, again, you say we don't talk about what goes in training because we don't know what goes on in training. But maybe they do work on these very slick attacking moves all the time, but it's not translating into what we're seeing on the pitch, and it remains a problem.
It was interesting. I read some comments from Van der Beek, a new signing, and he was alluding to the fact that they don't move the ball very quickly and it's very stagnant. And coming from Ajax, he's obviously used to moving the ball quickly, and I think that maybe that's something he's alluding to what's happening in training. I don't think they do much on the stuff that we talked about, Roy Hodgson and teams, the best teams do, about moving the ball unopposed, everyone knowing where they're going to be and being fluent in possession. And it's going to be a big, big test for them now when other teams sit in.
Well, I think the other question about training as well is how, you know, Lindelof looks not quite good enough. Eric Bailly looks not quite good enough. Chris Smalling, who had a brilliant season at Roma last season, looked not quite good enough. So why is it that the second centre-back always looks not quite good enough? Is it really those three aren't quite good enough, or is there something more fundamental going on with the structure of the team?
Or I wonder if you were positing there that, you know, Harry Maguire isn't as good as people think he is.
Well, it might be an issue with playing alongside Maguire. It might just be that they're not doing the shape work properly, so they keep getting caught out of position.
I also think they're quite exposed as well. I think they need a proper holding midfielder. I think, especially down the channels, if you get Lindelof one-on-one, it's a big problem. If you get Harry Maguire one-on-one in those sort of areas, it's a big problem. I think they need a holding midfielder that can double up and maybe even stop the supply into them or double up and help them, because they, when they're exposed, it's a problem.
Well, the good news there is that they have now Pogba, Van de Beek and Fernandes, who ideally should all be on the pitch. So good luck fitting a holding midfielder in there.
Exactly.
Rasmus says, Johnny Liu suggested a sturdy chest of drawers would be an upgrade on Victor Lindelof. Which other pieces of furniture would improve United's defence?
Well, not a clock, because a clock has extraneous hands, which would just be giving away penalties all over the place.
Is a clock furniture?
Big grandfather clock, yeah, which has got the necessary height.
Well, I think the sort of the sturdy chest of drawers would also be an improvement on Chelsea's goalkeeper. So generally exciting times ahead for furniture. These can just get on the pitch.
And this is from Peter Drury, with a solid 7 out of 10 on the Wilson dream scale today, commenting, "That's how he dreamt it after Donny van der Beek scores a debut loose ball tapping from 6 yards in front of an empty Stretford end during a global pandemic." Right, before we end part one, let's get into the games with a ridiculous amount of goals. Everton 5, West Brom 2. Some lovely goals in this game. Dean Garner's finish was good. James, he must be rubbish. He plays for Everton. Rodriguez with another brilliant one. Apologies again to Everton fans who are still angry with me. Pereira's free kick as well. Calvert-Lewin scored his first ever career hat-trick. He is a real talent. Can you predict how high he'll go in the game, please, Lars?
I think he's a good striker. I think he has a very unusual combination of strength and agility and speed. Like, he gets around the pitch really well, but he's also really strong and good in the air. And that's an unusual physical mix that you don't see that often. And he's very under Ancelotti. I think he's been told to stay more central because he doesn't wander as much as he used to be. I mean, he's someone who'd sort of turn out on the wings now and again. He's sticking more in front of goal and getting more chances and increasingly scoring them. And I think with a more competent team behind him, which I think he'll have this season, I think he'll score a bunch of goals.
Did you think this was a bit of a sign that Everton, perhaps, who were brilliant against Spurs, you know, they didn't have it all their own way, and had Kieran Gibbs not been an idiot, this really could have gone either way, this game, Marcus?
Yeah, I think it would have been a real test. I think Everton have built a very good, strong squad now. I think that Calvert-Lewin, I think that's probably his level personally, Everton. I don't think he maybe squeezed into a top six team. But I think moving forward, I think West Brom look like they're going to be in big trouble.
Well, I mean, I'm just appalled by the doubt that people are showing in Everton. I think Calvert-Lewin will win 3 Champions Leagues with Everton. and you know, anybody who suggests Everton doomed to be a stepping stone club forever is categorically wrong. No, I mean, yes, you're right in that West Brom gave them a proper challenge. I think you can spin that the other way, though, and say they went behind, they let in a goal where their midfield just sort of parted, and yet they had the wherewithal to get back and were 2-1 up at half time, even before the Gibbs incident. So, yeah, going forward, they're just really good. And, you know, I think there's a really nice balance there. And I think, you know, there's already, you can see the relationship between James and Richarlison, which I think would be really important. But Calvert-Lewin gives them something, you know, a bit of physicality to go on top of all the technical skill behind him. So I think there's great balance.
I'm a massive fan of James Rodriguez completing no sprints in this game. It's a statistic that was doing the rounds. he had a lot of successful touches and all that, but no sprints registered. As someone who is a little bit worried about...
He must have sprinted at one point. How do they judge that?
It could be that he's so slow that his sprints actually don't register as sprints. That could be. There was a stat that was shown on Match of the Day, I think it was, that he had no sprints. I've frequently bemoaned the rise of sort of athleticism in football, that everything is about pressing and running, and I worry that we're sort of losing the languid, you know, casual players, that they're just not going to make it anymore. And I used to like those. So having someone who's definitely not that physical play a central role at a very decent team in the league, I'm excited about.
Marcus, what is Kieran Gibbs doing? I mean, you just think you're in a game, you're playing well. It wasn't really that much of a kick from James either. Like, you've just got to be better than that.
I know Kieran, and he's a really chilled out guy, so I just don't know what happened there. He definitely obviously saw some red mist. That's inexplicable, to be honest, knowing what type of character he is, and obviously it's cost his team.
Yeah, and talking of Red Mist, Slaven Bilic had the, you know, he went wild, didn't he? He said to Mike Dean, you know, look at the foul. And that was enough for Mike Dean to just get a red card straight. I mean, just like a pub bouncer, you know, I think somebody like the referee's assessor, someone like a bigger boss should have come down, a bigger referee, and sent Mike Dean off for that. It's just what a power trip. Just, you know, I don't know, if did he ever ref you, Marcus?
No, he's never ref me, but he just comes across as very arrogant. And, you know, I was absolutely raging with that. Like, I felt so angry about he'd done that to Bilic, because he was actually quite polite, Bilic, if you went, just yeah. Be honest.
And there's just nothing wrong. Just somebody go, you know, it's not an even discussion, is it? If someone has a red card in their pocket and just says, go away, go away, go away, red card. You just think, do you not realise how many people are going to hate you for just being such a bell end? I know that's not necessarily insight, but that's how I felt about it.
But I mean, is it not the case that sometimes the best referees, like the best teachers, are not great people?
Do you think he's one of the best?
Mike Dean, yeah, I do. Yeah,
okay.
I mean, look, I really like Slaven as a bloke, but I think you probably as a manager shouldn't kind of go over to a referee. Okay, he wasn't verbally aggressive, but he was sort of, and maybe it's just his natural demeanour is physically aggressive. I'm not sure that the manager should be doing that. I wish referees would be more proactive in stopping dissent.
This is from Joe Whitehead, and it's from a game show. I don't know what it is. And it says, what is the confectionery-inspired nickname of the football club Everton? Len has got it. There are eight competitors, right? Len is the only one to get it right with toffees. Anisha went Maltesers. Peter, Twix. Abby went Quality Street. Arminal went Maltesers. Max went All Sorts. Jackie Humbugs. And Tristan, as he said, went Crisps, as Joe tweeted, up the fucking Crisps. Which I just thought made me laugh a great deal. Anyway, that'll do for part one. We'll start part two at St Mary's. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Southampton 2, Tottenham Hotspur 5. The first four of Spurs' goals, Harry Kane to Heung-min's Son. The first time in Premier League history one player has assisted another four times in a single match. The time on the clock for Son's first goal, 46:36. The time on the clock for Son's second goal, 46:31. He went back in time to score his second. Lars, this was an odd game.
Yes.
Because Southampton were the better side.
Yes.
I mean, for quite a lot of it. And then they just forgot to have any defenders.
Well, it is. There are certain things in football where if you do them and they go wrong, not only do you concede goals, but you look really stupid. Like zonal marking on corners, if it goes completely wrong, it just looks objectively stupid compared to like a marker losing his man. And I think like the high line, you could put Jorginho skipping a hop for the penalty as well. It's one of those things. If it goes wrong, you look daft. If you play with a high line and it goes wrong, it just looks a bit silly, especially when it happens several times in the same game. Now, I'm not quite as ready to sort of slaughter Southampton's tactical approach. It's worked really well for them since the turn of the year. But Spurs were certainly very, very good in game behind them. And I think it's really interesting to see Harry Kane sort of, I think, gradually becoming and more of a facilitator as well as a goal scorer. He is very good at dropping off a little bit and playing these little balls through. So with the arrival of Gareth Bale as well, they're going to have two very dangerous goal scoring winger Spurs, and they have a centre forward who's, you know, quite well suited to enabling them. So that's an exciting thing to watch for Spurs going forward. But the game definitely could have gone the other way, you felt, in the first half. And for Tottenham, I mean, three of their first four shots in the game went in. That's not going to happen every week. So, bit of an outlier, perhaps, but three very important points for them.
Isn't the point, though, if you've noticed that something isn't working, that you change it? I mean, Spurs got in behind Southampton, but it's not like it was difficult for them to do that.
I kind of disagree with that, because I think if you play one way and this is what the team does, and it doesn't work for a period of time, just do it better. Like, you don't necessarily change the formation and the approach just because it's not working for a period. The problem here was that you need to put pressure on the man on the ball. Like, if you're defending with a high line, you can't allow people to pick passes because then you'll be in trouble. It's the intensity in midfield, and Hasenhüttl mentioned that after the game.
But if you can't get pressure on the ball, you have to drop, right? And that's something that they didn't do. So Harry Kane was picking up the ball in the pocket, and they were still holding that line, and it didn't even take amazing movement for Son to get in. And that's that very worrying thing. It's just kind of basic runs, and he's straight through on goal. And as a defender, as a player, I think you can't sometimes it can't always come from the manager. You need leaders on the pitch that are going to say, "Hold on a second, this isn't working. Let's just drop." Any time Harry Kane gets the ball and faces up, we have to drop, and they didn't, and they were punished.
And Tottenham are very good at exploiting teams who play a high line and don't quite get it right. If you think of the Leicester game towards the end of last season, when I think Soyuncu was suspended, so Wes Morgan came in, and Wes Morgan, his turning circle is perhaps not as small as it used to be. And you know, Tottenham scored three in half an hour, 40 minutes in that game, and it was all, again, very similar goals. So Tottenham are very good at exploiting that if you do get it slightly wrong.
Philippe Auclair tweeting, "If England is still looking for a proper number 10, there's a certain Harry Kane who wouldn't look that bad in that role. His long-term future may well be there. And yes, I'm absolutely serious." You know, that people have sort of said he's a mixture of Shearer and Sheringham. And that was quite... I mean, what the one of the balls was absolutely beautiful, right? It was. You're right. Some of them, he had a lot of time and space to make the pass. But one of them was just... absolutely superb.
But do you know, I think that's what Southgate's trying to do with Sterling and Sancho going beyond him.
Yeah, possibly.
I mean, that's the same pattern, right? So,
but I just think it's a logical development in football, because we're seeing so many really dangerous goal-scoring wide players now that it makes complete sense for more and more centre-forwards to sort of adapt to enable them rather than just being finishers themselves. So in the same way that Firmino plays that role for Liverpool, you can imagine Kane doing something similar with England, with sort of Sterling and Sancho either side of him, and with Son and Kane either side of him, and Son and Bale either side of him at Tottenham.
Mike asks, on the subject of Bale arriving, ask Marcus what it's like in the dressing room when a big player is signed. How does the squad react? Is it always positive? Are wages ever an issue? I'm not sure if Mike has misremembered you spending 3 years at Real Madrid, Marcus. But you know, in relative terms, when a star player arrives, or someone arrives on big money, what impact can that have?
It normally has a really positive impact. It boosts everybody. As footballers, you want to be playing with the best, and you want to be winning stuff. And if someone's going to come in and help you do that, then it can only be positive. I think when it turns a bit sour is when that player doesn't deliver, and people are looking around and saying, "Hold on a second, he's on 300 grand a week and I'm on X amount, but my productivity is a lot higher than his." That's when it can sometimes become an issue. So as long as Bell's doing the business, and then people like Harry Kane, who probably be on a little bit less than him, won't have any complaints, because he's helping him achieve what Harry Kane wants to do, which is win trophies.
Dele Alli wasn't in the squad. Jose saying, "Does Dele Alli need to be sacrificed? No, but a squad is a puzzle. We have a huge squad with numbers that are difficult to manage. We have too many players for some positions, and some of them are paying the price for this. He's fresh. He has to be motivated by being out of the squad for a couple of matches. Rumours that he's been offered to PSG. Inter might be interested in him." Jose posted a picture of Kane after the game on Instagram with "top players are team players." Maybe he's just praising Kane, or is he saying something? Or is producer Ian reading far too much into whoever manages Jose's Instagram account? Interesting Dele Alli, isn't it? Sort of where he fits in that Tottenham team and whether he should move on.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem to have gone... I mean, he's still young, isn't he? But it does seem to have gone pretty sour for him pretty quickly. If you think how good he was, even at the World Cup, so what, 2 years ago, it's got to the point now where it's not that much of a surprise not to see him in, not only not in the team, but not in the squad. So, I don't know, maybe he does need a fresh start to shake things up. But, the odd thing is, he seemed to be the one player who really had developed in the first month under Mourinho. He seemed to be the one who kind of had got a lift out of that. So, and that's only a year ago. So, I don't know, it's not right at the minute, though.
Leeds 4, Fulham 3, two games for Leeds that have both ended 4-3. I mean, that's fun, isn't it? They look fun going forward. They concede lots of goals. What if anything, does it tell us, Marcus, apart from their games might be quite fun all season?
I think it's going to be, it's going to be an exciting ride, a roller coaster. And I think that they can't be sustainable conceding three goals every game. They're going to come unstuck. So Bielsa really needs to think about how he tightens things up. But listen, I'm going to enjoy watching them.
Will he think about that, Wilson?
Well, he did, to be fair. I think on Saturday, I think there's three things from the game, or maybe it's one thing and then another thing that's got two parts. But so point one, they were, as at Anfield, incredibly efficient in front of goal. And that again, is something Bielsa pointed out afterwards, that they're not going to score that many goals with that few chances on a regular basis. But then the second thing is, after they've gone 4-1 up, they have that sort of slightly sloppy quarter of an hour or so when Fulham get two back. And so do you worry about that? Or do you look at the last 20 minutes when actually they were really good defensively and they didn't, you know, they barely conceded a chance? So they can tighten it up. But, I mean, fundamentally, he's not going to change his approach. It's little tweaks. And I think both games have been slightly freakish so far. I don't think they've both been 4-3 games.
David says, can Patrick Bamford flip the stereotypical narrative? Can score goals in the Championship, not in the Premier League, to doesn't score enough in the Championship but bangs them in the Premier League? He looked really great, Lars, I thought.
He really did, and I think a lot. I mean, I've been guilty about this. I wanted to make this point on the pod that I've done that a few times to say, oh, well, Bamford, he doesn't score enough. But the thing about it is, like, you can, it is possible to get goals from other players than your centre forward. But in Bielsa's system, you do need a centre forward who goes through all the work that Bamford does. I mean, he's tremendously hardworking off the ball in terms of putting opponents under pressure and doing the pressing game and also his movement off the ball. You know, if you have a forward who does all that work but maybe doesn't always score as many goals as you'd want, you can get goals from other players. Whereas if you have a centre forward who doesn't go through all of that work, no one can do that for you. Like, there's no one in that place who can do that work off the ball, do the pressing. And if you don't have a centre forward who does it, the whole system falls down. So I think, you know, some of the criticism of him has been slightly simplistic and unfair.
But I don't think it's a ridiculous point at all to suggest that you may be able to score goals at a high level, but not at a lower level. So one of the most revealing sort of interviews I ever did was with Samuel Eto'o, and it was in Cairo in 2006. And I walked into the room, and he was lying in bed, and he was watching. I don't even know what game it was, but some local like Egyptian or North African league game on TV. And I said to him, "Well, what are you watching?" And he went, "I don't really know, but it's kind of rubbish football." And I said, "Well, what are you watching it for?" And he said, "Well, the runs you have to make are different according to how good the opponent is. So I'm watching poor opponents to learn where the space is, where I need to move when I'm playing into weaker teams." And that seemed to me incredibly sort of smart. And you sort of saw how interestingly Eto'o thinks about the game, that the runs you make are not the same against all opponents. You have to tailor them to the, not just the style of the opponent, but the quality of the opponent.
Was he sort of lying in bed in pyjamas? And did you conduct the interview while he was sort of lying there in bed?
He was, I hope he's wearing something on his lower half. His upper half appeared to be naked. He was under the covers.
And you interviewed him while he lay in bed?
Yeah, it was in his hotel room in a hotel in northern Cairo during the Cup of Nations.
And did you sort of sit next to his bed like a doctor? Did you stand there? Or did you?
Yeah, it was very much like he was a sickly patient, and I just brought some grapes and a magazine.
I was just going to continue on because I remember Wilson telling that anecdote a number of years ago, and I had Eto'o in my mind as a sort of unusually intelligent striker. So I interviewed him once when he was at Chelsea, and I thought, this is something I really want an answer to, so I'm going to ask Eto'o. You know, as a striker, as you go past 30 and, you know, maybe you're not quite as fast as you once were, do you have to adapt your game? Do you have to do things differently? And he looked me straight in the eye and said, "No, I'm still as fast as I ever was." And I did not feel like contradicting him because he looked slightly terrifying.
You know, was Samuel Eto'o dressed? Was he horizontal? Or what? You know, was he sitting on a chair?
He was sitting, but he had the sort of, his body language was, he was giving me a stare, and his whole sort of body was like a coiled spring. It was like, if I dare suggest again that he's not quite as fast as he used to be, he might immediately jump over and throttle me. I mean, that was very much the vibes I was getting.
Oh, right.
So I decided not to press him on the issue.
Oh. I mean, he was very relaxed when I spoke to him.
The key of the interviewer is to relax the subject. So,
you know. In bed with Samuel Eto'o has great potential as a sort of weekly vignette, sort of just under the duvet with him watching something on the TV, just having a chat about life.
Leicester 4, Burnley 2. This is a very open game, wasn't it? Leicester deserved it, Marcus, but Burnley had their chances too.
Yeah, they did. I thought that Burnley lacked that kind of intensity in their press and they're getting close and trying to win the ball as they usually do. And Leicester looked pretty good. Burnley had their chances, the usual kind of cross into the box and set plays. But I was impressed with Leicester.
And they're top of the league, Wilson. And a lot of people were worried about Leicester City this season.
Yeah, I mean, you say they deserved it. And sort of watching the game, that was sort of certainly the... I was watching the highlights of the game. That was certainly the sort of impression I got. But I found it very hard to assess last season because they seemed preposterously good before Christmas and preposterously bad after Christmas. And the only real sort of explanation I could find was the injury to Ndidi, that although he was only out for five games, he never quite got it back. And I think, you know, him coming back in the side has helped. You know, they also were missing Chilwell and Pereira and Maddison the last sort of eight games last season. So, you know, clearly the injuries do hurt them. But, you know, they've started very, very well. And Vardy looks as sharp as ever.
Harvey Barnes was man of the match. Does anyone feel that Harvey Barnes shouldn't be sort of a quick winger? And just the way he looks to me like he should just be a sort of generic central midfield player. Does that make any sense to anyone else?
Well, he's got a touch of the McCarthy's MacArthur's, hasn't he, about him?
Exactly, yeah. And then he, so when I first saw him, I was very surprised at sort of how quick he was. And if he can get his end product right, I think he's got like a, he's got real potential, I think.
Do you think that was his goal, or do you think it clipped Perez on him? I mean, Perez certainly was claiming it, wasn't he? Or trying to claim it.
I don't know. I don't mind either. anyway, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll do the other two Premier League games and any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start at the Emirates. Arsenal 2, West Ham 1. Good header from Lacazette. Eddie Nketiah's late winner. And a lovely through ball from Saka to set Ceballos free for that winner. What did you make of this football match, Lars Sivertsen?
I thought West Ham were actually not that bad. You were a little bit worried for them, sort of getting tonked by Newcastle at home in the opening day of the weekend is not usually something that hard. See, that's not a good sign for life or in general. But they were much improved and they gave Arsenal a good fight, and they were unlucky to not get anything from this, to be honest.
Yeah, West Ham's equaliser was lovely, wasn't it? And they had chances at 1-1, Marcus. And given the sort of state of anxiety around the London Stadium, getting anything from this game would have been so big for them.
Yeah, it would have been massive. Obviously, there's a lot of turmoil going there at the moment. Arsenal looked pretty abject in creating chances, pretty poor from their point of view. And I think West Ham were unfortunate not to capitalise, and they created some really good chances.
I think that's quite an interesting part of games like this, where we sort of see the opening game of the season and we set our narrative out. You know, Arteta has got Arsenal right. They are going to be great. West Ham are hopeless. You know, Everton are the best footballing team in the world, etc., etc. And sort of, I suppose, over a season, we learn how much rubbish we've spoken for the previous 38 weeks.
Yeah, no, I think you're spot on. I think Arteta will get it right, and he's shown, proven before that he has. I don't think there's anything too much to worry about in that terms of that. And I think West Ham will be fine this season. I'm not writing them off after the first game. I think they'll survive quite comfortably.
Just to be clear, I am writing West Ham off, and I wrote them off before the first game. So my prejudices were set in stone a long time ago.
Do you disagree with Marcus then that you think they really will struggle this season?
I think there's two huge problems at the club. There's the squad and there's the manager. And if both of those are wrong, I don't really know how you go forwards. So, yeah, the squad has got this really awkward split between the sort of hard-working, grafting sort of 6, 7 out of 10 players, and then the players who have been bought because they might be 8 or 9 out of 10 players, but somehow don't quite seem to fit and it doesn't quite work for them.
But don't you need that split? Don't you need a balance of your McCarthy's and your MacArthur's, and you need your fun fancy players who might be a 3 or might be a 9.
Yeah, but there's a balance to be, well, there's a difference between having a balance and having an enormous divide between two completely separate types of player. And you know, Moyes, I think this is still true, it was certainly true when I wrote the piece, which was towards the end of last season. I don't think his first substitution in the game has had a positive impact on the result in all this time at West Ham. And so, although West Ham were pretty unlucky on Saturday, although they were probably the better team, you also just get a sense of Moyes now. He doesn't have, I don't know, the charisma, the energy, the spark, the tactical wit, whatever it is, to sort of grab a game and make it go in the right direction. Whereas Arteta clearly does have that. And the positive stuff we're saying about Arteta wasn't based purely on the first game of the season. It was based on the final month of last season, the fact they won the FA Cup, and they won the FA Cup semi-final, they beat Liverpool in the league, and the fact that they at least matched Liverpool in the Community Shield as well. So while absolutely we have a tendency to overplay the opening day of the season and read too much into that, I think in the case of West Ham and Arsenal, what happened on the first day of the season was following a trend that had been identifiable towards the end of last season.
I suppose even though with West Ham they have a you know, they've got the two problems you suggest, the players and the manager. At least everyone's behind the owners. So that is, you know, yeah. They don't have that issue.
Look, the owners are fine. The stadium's fine.
I think you're being a little bit harsh. I mean, they were looking gradually more competent, I thought, towards the end of last season. And I mean, I wouldn't be mega excited if David Moyes turned up and was in charge of a team I supported. Like, I'm not sure I'd get the bunting out for Moyes. But I do think...
Trust me, I've been there. You don't need bunting. You can save on the bunting.
But I do kind of think that if you put David Moyes in charge of a squad of sort of reasonably competent Premier League players, he will turn them into a competent, if unspectacular, team who'll finish 13th. I mean, I think that's something he has in his locker. And
well, okay, let's assume that's true. West Ham have got the 8th highest wage bill in the Premier League, and last season they finished 16th.
Yeah, it's not ideal, but you know, but what I'm getting at here is I think the problem is the fixture list has really not been very good for them. They've got Wolves away, they've got Wolves at home next time out, then Leicester away, then Spurs away, then City at home, and then Liverpool away. Like, it's entirely possible that they'll get to sort of 7 games into the season and have no points. Without really having had any disgraceful results, aside from the Newcastle thing. And I wonder if that will trigger so much negativity from the fans, from the press, and also from within the squad itself. Everyone will just be miserable, that it'll just be impossible to turn it around.
Look, there is a truth to that. They had a hard start to the season. But on the other hand, if you finish 16th, more than 3/4 of your games are going to be against teams who are better than you.
Yeah, I remember last year. Was it last year? Maybe it's every season. I've looked at West Ham's fixture list and thought, they're not going to get a point until November. And then they go and win some game that you just absolutely don't expect them to do. On the subject of their ownership, US consortiums made 2 unsuccessful offers, $350 million at the start of August, $400 million a few weeks later. They're preparing a third bid. A deal with the owners, Golden Sullivan, will be hard. Sullivan owns a majority shareholding of 51.5%. And I don't think he really wants to sell. The deal under which West Ham moved to the London Stadium includes an agreement that Sullivan and Gold will have to pay financial penalties to the taxpayer if the club is sold before March of 2023. To St James's Park now, Newcastle 0, Brighton 3, which I suspect puts West Ham's defeat to Newcastle in some sort of perspective, doesn't it? James says, can a right-back win the Ballon d'Or? Just asking for Tarek Lamptey. Thomas saying, Lamptey clocked up 35 kilometres an hour in that first half. At that speed, he could run from Brighton to Portsmouth in around 2 hours. And Kevin said, he would be speeding in most of central Brighton, which I liked. Marcus, what an exciting player he is.
Yeah, he's a huge talent. One I watched a little bit when I was doing some scouting for Brentford. He's absolutely rapid, looks so comfortable on the ball, able to go past players at will. And it's a fantastic signing for like £1.8 million. You know, it's an absolute snip. And yeah, I think Brighton have got a real player in their hands.
When you're scouting, do you have like a little checklist, or do you just have good, bad, and then hand the piece of paper over?
No, we have criteria that we've got to look for. Yeah, so obviously that ranges from pace, strength, tactical awareness, technical positioning, technique on the ball. So there's lots of things we're looking for, and if you fair, you tick most of those boxes.
What's been the impact of COVID on scouting?
So at the moment, teams are only allowed to go and watch games that they're playing the opposition in the next three games. So that means that we can't go and watch random players as we'd like to. We're very restricted. So at the moment, everything's done on different platforms like Instat, Y-Scout, where we can watch full games once they've been played.
How does it work that you just go, I think this player's great, and then does a manager completely trust you, or do they go and watch them? Or do you ever have a moment where you've recommended someone, they've been signed and they've turned out to be absolutely rubbish?
Now, there's a long process. You know, even if you like a player, they still need to be watched multiple times by different people, different departments before it ever gets over the line. So yeah, there's a long, very long process.
All right. Newcastle failed to have a single shot on target in this game. Steve Bruce said it was an awful afternoon. We never gave ourselves a chance. We have to try to put things right. That's a sort of disappointing sentence to have to utter in week 2 of the season.
It is, but you know what? I think we should be giving Brighton more credit. I think Brighton occupied this sort of place in our minds as a sort of slightly soft team who should be beaten at home in particular. I think we're dramatically underestimating the job that Graham Potter's done there. Watched them opening round of the season and I thought, wow, here we're watching Well, last weekend I watched them and we were thinking, wow, I'm really watching a team that's coached by one of the brightest young managers around, and Chelsea were also playing in that game. And I thought they were very, very good, Brighton. You can see they're very well coached. Everyone knows what they're doing. And Graham Potter has done tremendously well. It deserves credit.
How well can they do? How high can they go?
I think that kind of depends. It's the old saying about... I'm not going to say it again because this is my annual sort of... But, you know, you don't have to outswim the shark. You just have to outswim your sister. So, like, how far they can get up the table depends on what the teams around them do. But they should be perfectly safe. They shouldn't be mucking about around the relegation battle, for sure.
Basuma was sent off for a sort of backwards roundhouse kick into the face of Jamal Lewis. Samuel writes, based on Clinton Morrison thinking Basuma should not have been sent off because he didn't mean it, should pundits be made to sit an exam to show they know the laws of the game before being paid to give their opinions? Marcus, I mean, you know Clinton, I know Clinton. I mean, he's a great bloke.
He's a great bloke, and yeah, he's normally wrong and strong. That's what we call him. The rules of the game say if you kick someone in the face, you get sent off whether you meant it or not. And yeah, so Clinton's wrong on that one.
But I do think when we're talking about these decisions, it's completely fine to say, I think the rule should say something else. Like, if you feel that as long as you don't intend it, you should never get sent off, it's okay to have that opinion. But you also have to acknowledge that the rules of the game don't say that right now. And I think what I found odd was that he was apparently sent off for violent conduct, but I would have said this was more serious foul play because I thought he was endangering the opponent. So it seems like I'm slightly confused about the law they've applied, but the right result was there.
Yeah, that's what baffles me. The PGMOL released that statement, which was read out Match of the Day 2 last night, saying that it was for violent conduct. Well, it can't be violent conduct. The ball's there. You know, However dangerous that is, it is an attempt to play the ball. You know, the ball is vaguely near his foot. So, yeah, it seems strange to me. But I don't understand why not only the IFAB laws, but also the guidelines to referees that are given at the start of the season. I don't know why they're not just openly released so we could actually read them and try and understand this before you get practical examples.
Games tonight, Villa, Sheffield United, Wolves, City. We'll cover them on tomorrow's pods. We're doing a Euro pod with Sid, Nicky and Archie, so look, we'll talk about them briefly tomorrow, but if something extraordinary happens, we will. Otherwise, we might do it on Thursday. Chris says, if Max played up front for Manchester City, how far down the pyramid would he have to go before he fancied himself scoring a goal? It's a good question. I think if I started every game and played 90 minutes for City this season, I reckon I might get 10.
That's five, a higher number five? Than I thought you were going to say.
Wow.
Five? What do you reckon, 5? Just, you know, just eventually, like, you're just going to have a tap-in from 5 yards, right?
I'm going 2.
You reckon 2?
I'm thinking pretty early on they're going to stop passing to you.
Well, yeah, I know. Obviously they would, but I just, you know, the odd set piece would sort of drop. How many would you get, Marcus?
I'll get 5.
You get 5. Okay, I don't want to say 10.
But okay, I think City is a sort of difficult example because they're so good at playing that sort of ball across the face of goal. So if you just gamble every single time someone's down the flank there, I think Wilson's right. They probably would stop aiming for you. But at some point, yeah. I don't think you'd get any from Man United, Max.
I also worry for your state of mind when every half time, every full time, Guardiola's on the pitch grabbing you by the face, screaming at you for not following his tactical instructions.
What happens after the pod, no?
To the Football League, Peter says, how bad might it get for Wickham this season, Marcus? I'm not goading, I live there, I'm massively fond of Ainsworth and the club. They got humped 5-0 by Blackburn after losing to Rotherham on the opening day and going out to Brentford in the Carabao Cup. Do you fear for them?
It's going to be a tough season, and I think no one at the club was under any illusions that it wouldn't be. As we know, they've probably got by far the lowest budget, and it's going to be tough. I think this is a season where they've got to go out and take every game as it comes and enjoy the ride as it goes. If they do manage to stay up, it will be one of the greatest stories in football. and yeah, just enjoy it.
MW White says, question for the pod. Do you think the invincible season is on for Cambridge United? Kai says, should there be a lower league Ballon d'Or across the smaller European divisions, mainly to recognise the genius that is Wes Houlihan? We won 5-0 at Morecambe. We're top of League Two. It's so ludicrous. I don't know if you get this, Wilson, if Sunderland ever have a good start to a season, that I've just been staring at the league table.
What do you mean? If they ever have, we've taken 4 points from two games. We won away at Oxford, and Lyndon Gooch scored the equivalent of John Barnes' goal in the American Hour on Saturday. We've had a great start of the season, apart from the first game.
Yeah, we've been staring at the League One table because I've been looking at the league. It's two games. It's just so nice to see your team at the top of it.
They're below Lincoln City, Ipswich, and Doncaster, so maybe not stare at the table that much.
Yeah, I don't need to stare at it. If we keep playing like this, then we'll scrape into the playoffs. That's great.
Question for Lars. How many goals will Bodo Glimt? Is it Bodo or Glimt beat Milan?
Bodo Glimt, yeah.
How much will they beat Milan on Thursday?
So Bodo Glimt are playing Milan in the Europa League. Mm. Now, the thing about Bodo Glimt is that they're not a huge team. They're a bit of a sort of, I'd almost say a yo-yo club. They get relegated occasionally. They're from a town sort of pretty far up north in Norway, not a huge place. 18 games into the league season, they're undefeated. They've won 16, drawn 2, and lost nil. They've scored 65 goals in these 18 games. I mean, we've not seen anything like it. It's absolutely baffling what they're doing this season. They're completely running away with the league without having any sort of large investments in them or anything. They're just playing really, really well. And now they're going to face Milan in the Europa League qualifiers. It's very exciting.
Danny says, I expect about 25 minutes on the pod about this event from our league today, from Ilkley Town FC's Twitter feed. Crazy scenes at Carlton Athletic v Ilkley Town as Joe Garside drops his shoulder and leaves the alpaca for dead. An alpaca running onto the field, which is a lovely sign at that level of football. Matt says, on the subject of players returning to their former club, I can't believe none of the panel came up with Ian Rush returning to Liverpool after a disastrous spell at Juve. It's a very good point. Andrew says, just listening to the pod where I said arguably Scatman's best days are behind him. Arguably, question mark, says Andrew. Yes, Scatman John Paul Larkin sadly passed away in 1999. So I was right. His best days are behind him. But thank you for the music. On the subject of music, Bombay Bicycle Club got in touch when I started talking about the, as they say, excellent segment on the podcast about the horrors of 2010's indie bands on Soccer AM. We spent a fair bit of time preparing for the kick at the end, they said. I never expect anyone to actually be listening who might be involved in the things I'm talking about, but I certainly remember them being delightful people. And thank you for listening to this podcast. And Nick says, not a question, but some praise to John Bruin for his emotional piece on Macclesfield on Thursday. As a Blackburn fan who's lived in London for nearly 40 years, his comment on about how seeing your club reconnects you with your hometown was absolutely spot on. Yeah, thanks, Nick. Lots of people praised John for that, and rightly so. And that is pretty much all we have time for today. Marcus, thank you for your time.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
Thank you, Lars.
Thanks, Max.
Back tomorrow. Back tomorrow. I turned into the policeman from Hello, Hello. Well, it is a Euro special, so I suppose, you know, maybe I'll host it in that way. Good morning. It will be Sid Lowe, Nicky Bandini, and Archie Rintat. We'll see you then.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.